Thank you very much, Rabbi Weissman. We don't have that much time, so I'll try to get directly to the point. An aguna, broadly defined, is a woman who is chained, literally anchored in a non-functional marriage, where she is unable to be freed, either because her husband is presumed to be dead, but cannot be adequately proven to be dead, or because her husband is very much alive, but is unable or unwilling to grant his wife a get, a Jewish divorce. Our rabbis have struggled for thousands of years to ensure shelo yehu benos Yisrael agunot, that all measures be taken in order to free our daughters from becoming or remaining agunot. Today, we will focus primarily upon the case of the husband who is unwilling to grant his wife a get when the marriage is functionally over, either because a betin has determined that a get should be given, or because the husband and wife no longer desire to live with each other. The primary problem that arises comes from the tension, on the one hand, between the principle of chumra de'eshes ish, that we have a principle that there is a tremendous severity of the prohibition of a married woman living with another man when she's still married to her first husband. That transgression is an iser kares. Any offspring who would be born from a relationship between a woman who is still married and has not received the get from her first husband and is living with another man would be illegitimate, would be a mamzer. So that causes us to be extremely circumspect, extremely careful to make sure that a get is given when a marriage is over so that the woman would be able to be in another relationship. On the other hand, when in fact we do have a difficulty because a husband is unwilling to give a get, or we have other problems that prevent a marriage from being dissolved when it is functionally over, we also have a competing principle of mishum aguna akilu bei rabbanan, that the rabbis have always tried to find leniencies whenever there is an aguna situation, to try to find some way, according to halacha, according to the Torah, that in fact a marriage can be dissolved, that in fact a problem situation can be fixed so that the woman will be able to move on with her life. So for example, in the case of the missing husband who is presumed to be dead but cannot be conclusively proven to be dead, the rabbis relaxed certain evidentiary rules, not requiring two kosher witnesses to attest to the man's death, but relying instead upon even one witness, even upon one witness who would not normally be considered to be a valid witness for other areas of Torah law. When it comes to the case of the husband who is very much alive, but is recalcitrant, who is refusing to give his wife a get, we find other measures of leniency, namely that when witnesses, for example, sign on a normal contractual document, we're very meticulous that they know exactly how to sign their names, but we find, for example, that in a get document, the Gemara teaches us, and this is recorded in Shulchan Aruch, that one can make an outline by tearing a paper in accordance with the outline of the letters of the witness's name, so the witness can basically use that outline in order to write his name, so that if there aren't other witnesses available, we're not going to unduly delay the writing of a get. So we do find that there are leniencies that are exercised across the board, while at the same time remaining steadfast to the basic proposition that without a get, if the husband is alive, the marriage, according to the Torah, cannot, in fact, be dissolved. And this is really derived fundamentally from a very clear pasuk in Sefer Devarim that says that when it comes to a man and a woman who are living together, in order for them to be separated, in order for the marriage to be dissolved, it is necessary, because of law, Sefer Krisus v'Nasan v'Yadav, the husband must actually write a bill of divorce and place the bill of divorce into his wife's hands. This is an act that has to be done voluntarily. The Rambam derives from the previous expression, v'hayah im lo simtzach ein v'einav, that it is only when the husband makes a conscious decision that he no longer wants to be in this marriage. Others derive it from the word benasan v'yadah. The Rashbam says, since it says benasan, that the husband has to give it to his wife, the implication is that he's giving it willingly. Therefore, the Torah makes it clear that in such a case, a get must actually be voluntarily written by the husband and given by the husband into his wife's hands. So what are the major sources of aguna situations today, of the problem of why it is that not every single case is resolved smoothly, why we do have certain instances where a woman either becomes an aguna or where there is a very difficult process that is necessary before the husband finally agrees to give his wife a get. So I would like to identify in the short amount of time that we have to this morning three basic issues that I have observed that lead to some of the problems that we have in our contemporary scene when it comes to aguna situations and aguna problems. The first is what I would call a lack of jurisdiction. It used to be that in most of the Jewish communities in Europe for many hundreds of years, the Jewish communities were much more autonomous. And therefore, as long as there was a structured court system, a Beis Din system within the Jewish community, it was generally understood that the Beis Din, that the Jewish rabbinical court, had jurisdiction over the members of their community. Even if they were not the governmental authorities and did not have the official court system in the country, at least for purposes of the Jewish community, they did have a certain amount of coercive power. Therefore, if there ever was a divorce situation, at the very least, they could summon and require the husband to appear before the Beis Din. And as we know from, I think, a famous Hollywood personality once observed, that 90% of success in life is just showing up. Once you have the husband in the door, and once you have the ability to exercise that jurisdiction, that already goes a very long way towards resolving the problem. In fact, if you look at some of the early literature of problem cases where a husband was refusing to give his wife a get in rabbinic sources, you find that many of the cases, if not most of the cases, involved men who were what we call mishumadim, men who had apostatized, who had left the religion to join a different religion, and therefore were no longer adherents to the community. Since they no longer were subject to the jurisdiction of the community, it was much more difficult to elicit their cooperation. But if a man actually lived within the community, then just as a civil court today could summon somebody in a court case to actually show up, and then they could issue a ruling, and then that ruling could be binding upon the party, so too the Jewish courts had that ability. We no longer have that ability. This is fortunately a free country, but one of the consequences of the separation between religion and state is that there is no ability to actually coerce a member of a religious community to appear before a religious court. And therefore, if somebody decides to be recalcitrant, we no longer have the same ability to ensure that they get through the door so that we would actually be able to issue a ruling and then only have to worry about the mechanisms at our disposal to enforce the ruling. We have no jurisdiction unless there are means that are found in order to ensure that jurisdiction. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a tshuva that he wrote about in Chelek Dalet of, I believe, Eben Ezer, I believe tshuva Kuf Zayin, in which he writes about the different possible solutions for the contemporary Aguna crisis, makes the very obvious point that we can go a long way towards resolving the problem by having simple prenuptial agreements. There's going to be a lengthier discussion shortly given by Rabbi Willich Shlita concerning the mechanism of the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement, but Rabbi Feinstein writes very simply that even without elaborate mechanisms, what would go a long way towards resolving the problem is just to have every couple, when they get married, sign an arbitration agreement. Sign an agreement that says that they agree to be bound by the jurisdiction of a particular Beis Din. And they simply write, just like you can do in America, the American system, you can always agree to submit yourself to an arbitration tribunal to resolve any dispute. parties can say, I want my disputes to be resolved by the American Arbitration Association. So parties can similarly, when they get married, say, if there's ever a dispute about a get, we agree that we will submit to a specific Besdin that we trust, and if that Besdin should rule that a get should be given, we will comply with the giving of a get. And that gives the Besdin the jurisdiction, and that already enables many of the problematic situations to be resolved, because it ensures that the husband can be actually compelled, as a matter of arbitration law, the husband can be compelled to appear before the Besdin. I remember I had a case when I was serving as director of the Besdin of America, where a couple had signed an arbitration agreement to appear before the Besdin, and that was it. They didn't sign any other document. There are other documents about monetary amounts of support, which are also very helpful. But in this case, there was simply an arbitration agreement that the husband agreed that in the event there was a dispute about the get, he would appear before the Besdin of America. And then the husband and wife had a falling out, and the marriage, unfortunately, was no longer viable. And it was a very nasty situation where the husband really did not want to give his wife a get or cooperate in any other way. And in fact, he ran off to Europe. And he ran off to some place in, I believe, the Netherlands. And the wife had absolutely no idea of what to do in order to address her problem. So she came to the Besdin, and we asked her if there was a prenuptial agreement, and she said, yeah, they signed this arbitration agreement, but what good is it going to do? The husband's not in America anymore. He ran off to the court in the Netherlands. So we told her, look, you have this document, and courts all over the world have a certain respect for legal documents. It's an English secular legal document that says that you're going to agree to submit to the Besdin. Why don't you hand it to whatever lawyer you have to represent you or present your case in this court in the Netherlands, and you'll see what happens. So she went to a lawyer. The lawyer presented the document before the court in the Netherlands, and the court said, this is a binding document. This is an arbitration agreement, and you are hereby required, they said to the husband, you are hereby required to make arrangements with the Besdin of America in New York to take care of the get issue. And as a result of that ruling, the husband got in touch with us. We got in touch with the local Orthodox Besdin in that area to arrange for a get to be commissioned by the husband and sent through an agent, sent to a shliach to be delivered to the wife in America, and we took care of the case. If not for the assumption of jurisdiction that was reflected by that document, I don't know how or if that case ever would have been resolved. Now, that leads to a tremendous advantage, of course, in the event that the parties are in Israel, that technically speaking, the Israeli Batei Din have automatic jurisdiction over the parties. So in an Israeli divorce case, as long as the husband doesn't leave the country, and sometimes in these types of cases, they actually issue what's called a tzav ikuv. They issue a restraining order that prevents the husband from leaving the country. In those cases, there is a much more potent jurisdiction that can be exercised by the Israeli Batei Din, because they can actually compel the husband to appear before them, and they actually have the jurisdiction to be able to enforce remedies even if the parties hadn't signed some sort of separate agreement. And that, if used wisely and if used efficiently, actually gives the ability to rein in certain recalcitrant husbands even more effectively if the husband happens to be found in Israel. We had one case where a husband was refusing to cooperate with Besdin. He wouldn't even show up before Besdin altogether. So what power do we have from an American law perspective, from a Jewish community in America perspective in that case? The main power that a Besdin has is to issue a siruf, to issue a decree of recalcitrance against the husband, a contempt order against the husband, and that contempt order will hopefully elicit communal pressure to be exercised against the husband in order to bring him to cooperate. But that helps primarily if the husband still has something to do with the community and cares about what people have to say and cares about the communal pressure that is brought upon him in the event that a Besdin issues a contempt order. I had this one fellow who didn't belong to any particular community, who wasn't such a sociable guy, to put it mildly, who was not somebody who had an affiliation with any synagogue or Jewish community, but there was an Orthodox marriage that took place between him and his wife, and now when the marriage completely broke down, he was refusing to give a get. So I managed to arrange for a meeting between myself and the husband. The husband had all kinds of, he agreed to the meeting. Why? Because he had all kinds of conditions that he thought that he would be able to impose upon his wife, that he wanted this, and he wanted this amount of money, and he wanted this amount of accommodations, and he wanted certain things on her part to be dropped against him, and so forth. And he went on and on with his demands, which were frankly unreasonable, and particularly unreasonable if he wasn't prepared to submit to a Beis Din process that would objectively assess all of his claims and reach a proper determination. And I said to him, look, if you don't submit to Beis Din, we're going to issue a seiruv against you. So he said, I don't care what you do to me. He said, I don't care if I sit in jail for the rest of my life. I'm not going to give her a get unless I get exactly what I want. And that was basically how this meeting concluded. And we issued a contempt order against the man. And true to his word, he still refused to give his wife a get. Then he went off to Israel. When he went off to Israel, so he had whatever family he had in Israel, and he figured this way he'd really be through with his wife. So once he got to Israel, we sent a copy of the seiruv, of the contempt order, to the Beis Din Hagadol, to the central Beis Din office, the Hanalat Beit HaDin in Israel. So they had now a copy of the seiruv, and they summoned him in. And they looked at the history of the case. They saw that a proper Beis Din, in their assessment, had issued a contempt order against this individual. And you know what they did to him? They put him in jail, because they actually had the jurisdiction to put him in jail. Well, it turned out that he was only bluffing, because as soon as they put him in jail, he said, you know what? I've changed my mind. I think I'll give her a get. So jurisdiction makes a tremendous amount of difference. In America, in our particular community, the best way, and really the only way, to ensure jurisdiction is for the parties to actually sign, when they get married, some sort of arbitration agreement that simply says, in the event that there's going to be a dispute about a get, they agree they'll submit that dispute to a Beis Din. That gives the Beis Din the jurisdiction and would give the Beis Din the ability to issue certain orders and decrees that could even be enforced by the secular court system, which would then be a proper exercise of Beis Din power according to halakha that could lead to the giving of a get. The second issue that I would discuss is the fact that you need to have what I call a koach. You need to have, within our communities, we need to build up as much as possible the strength that we have collectively as a community in order to impose pressure in those cases where we don't have the legalistic authority to impose or to coerce a man to give a get. Sometimes there is, I believe, a certain amount of misconception regarding at least the theoretical ability to coerce a get. We know the Rambam has a famous essay, a famous statement in Perek Beis, in Hilchos Gerushin, Halacha Chof, where he talks about the mechanism of why it is that it's ever appropriate to coerce a man into giving a get. And he explains that coercion is not a contradiction to the notion of a get being given voluntarily, because even when it's coerced, what you're really doing is just taking away a person's own self-inflicted coercion upon himself to follow the dictates of his evil inclination. And once you're taking away that self-imposed coercion, he's really acting voluntarily when he's complying with Jewish law by giving a get. And it is, in fact, a very beautiful philosophical exposition that is laid out by the Rambam. But what is less known is that the situations, according to halacha, where coercion is actually warranted are very few and far between. Most cases where there is what I would call irreconcilable differences, where there simply is a lack of harmonious relationship between the husband and wife, but you can't point to an egregious physical disease that the husband suffers from or domestic abuse that's taking place. Most cases, according to halacha, probably would not rise to the notion of a kofin where you actually could physically coerce a get. Never mind that it might be difficult for us to figure out
how we could, in practice, physically coerce somebody to give a get. But there is another resolution which is described by Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, one of the famous Rishonim, was of the opinion that, and we follow this opinion, that if a woman says, my husband is ma'isolai, he's repugnant to me, then we cannot coerce a get, but what we can do is what we call hachakos to Rabbeinu Tam. We're not allowed to impose penalties, but we are allowed to withhold benefits. You're allowed to withhold benefits from somebody in the goal of helping to put a certain amount of communal ethical pressure upon the individual that he understands that if he wants to be in good standing, he had better give his wife a get. So, for example, I remember we had one case where there was a fellow who was delaying giving a get, who was a president of his synagogue. And he wanted very much to remain in good standing, to remain the president of his synagogue. So we made it very clear to him that he would not be allowed to serve anymore in this capacity. The rabbi of his synagogue agreed to cooperate. We said that until you give your wife a get, you're not going to be allowed to serve in the capacity of president of your synagogue. So he gave his wife a get. In other situations, we have, in the cooperation with the Rabbinical Council of America, promulgated various resolutions that declare that if a man is refusing to cooperate with the Beis Din in terms of having a proper get process, then he will be denied membership privileges. Members of the synagogue are encouraged and urged not to invite the person to bar mitzvahs, to weddings, to social affairs, and so forth, to put a very clear statement out that this type of conduct is not going to be tolerated, and that a get should be given as promptly as possible under those circumstances. So therefore, it is necessary to galvanize as much as possible in these situations in order to enact these types of hachakos to Rabbeinu Tam, these types of community pressures of withholding benefits, withholding relationships from recalcitrant individuals in order to make it clear that this type of conduct will not be tolerated. This is why I think that one of the most constructive measures that has really been enacted over the last number of years was the creation of the organization ORA. I wasn't asked to give a plug for this organization. I'm doing this completely on my own. But the organization ORA, which stands for Organization of Resolution of Agunot, is an organization that acts upon when there is a contempt order that has been issued by a Beis Din against an individual for failure to comply with a Beis Din in the get process. They consult very carefully with Poskim. They also consult very carefully with legal counsel to make sure that everything that they do is legally appropriate in order to carry out appropriate demonstrations and other types of measures which are not coercive in nature, but which send a very clear and unequivocal message that this type of conduct is not going to be tolerated by our community. And finally, I would just end with the observation that the other really important thing that we need to do as a community, and which I found really led to problems in many cases, is that we need to have much more of a collective ethical consensus among members of the community across the board of this notion that it is never, ever appropriate, whether you're trying to help out a client as a lawyer, whether you're trying to help out a close friend or a family member, it is never appropriate to encourage somebody to hold off giving a get. It is never appropriate to say to somebody, you know what, you can use this get as a bargaining chip, you can use it as a negotiating tool, wait a little bit longer to see what else you can get, if you should delay the get for a little bit of time. That is something where we just have to put our foot down, and it has to be something which we educate our children about from a young age, something we educate our communities about. This is something where we need to have, we speak about in this university when it comes to academic integrity, a zero tolerance policy. We need to have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to these types of matters. I remember I was once serving on a Zavla Beis Din, a Beis Din where each side picks one dayan, the two dayanim pick a third dayan, and one of the tohanim, the rabbinic advocates, took aside one of the lawyers. There was a lawyer who was representing the woman, and he said to the lawyer, he said, you know, you don't really understand how this system works. said you need to understand that the get is something which has a value for the husband, and that it's something that he can bargain for, and you gotta give something in return for his giving a get. So instead of just clamoring, I want the get, I want the get, you gotta figure out what are you gonna give in order to receive the get. And I stood up at that moment, and I looked straight into his eyes, and I looked straight at her, at the lawyer, and I said, I just want to clear up this misconception right now. This is absolutely shekel. This is absolutely false. You give a get when a bezin declares that a get should be given. That's when a get should be given. The husband's obligation, when there is a dispute, is to submit to a bezin. When bezin says you give a get, it's not something which has any bargaining force, not something which is intended for negotiating purposes. It's not a leverage tool. This is something which you're just supposed to do. I'll conclude with the words of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein in Igros Moshe, Chelik Yoredeya, in Yoredeya, Chelik Dalet, Simen Tes Vav, makes a very astute observation, which I think really is the bottom line when it comes to the perspective on all of these types of cases. He says, whenever it is clear that you don't have a situation of Shalom Bayis, whenever it is clear that you don't have a viable marriage between a husband and a wife, said, forget about the technicalities of Kofin, whether you can physically coerce a get. He doesn't get into any of that. He just says, as a matter of appropriateness, it is inappropriate for either spouse, either for the wife to delay receiving the get, or for the husband to delay giving the get, whenever it's clear that a marriage is functionally over the way that B'nai Torah behave, the way that B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, behave, is that a get is given as a matter of course. And we have to inculcate this into our mindsets. We have to emphasize this in our communities. And we can never allow any case to be, oh, this is the exception. Because I know what a hard time my friend had in his marriage and how his wife really is beating him up, and she's pushing him to give a get as soon as possible, and she wants everything from him, and and she acted improperly in the following way herself. So that is never a justification. There are other remedies that are available for people who act improperly in other ways. Making somebody an aguna, refusing to give a get, is not such a way. We're now entering into Chodesh Adar. We know that there is a principle Chazal articulate, Mishenichnas Adar Ma'abim B'Simcha. We come into the month of Adar, we're supposed to have a greater amount of Simcha, a greater amount of happiness. The Gemara in Yevamos tells us that Kol Shari B'lo Isha, Shari B'lo Simcha, that when you don't have a viable, happy marriage situation, so then you don't really have happiness in this world. We should do our best to make sure that we free every single aguna who's out there and prevent every single possible aguna in order that we can maximize the ultimate simcha in this world, that everybody should be able to have happy and fulfilling marriages.